Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings, including the one barking behind me. In this episode, I talk to the activist, atheist, vegan philosopher, Floris van den Berg. He's published a number of books that lay out a largely sentientist way of thinking and has even starred in a Dutch reality TV show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And I'd love to know what you think. Why not write a review or give us some stars on your podcast platform? You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for the word sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll also be made very welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thank you for listening. Floris, it's great to meet you. This is the closest we'll get to in real life for the moment, but after some email conversations and some social media, it's wonderful to see your face and have the chance to have a proper conversation. So welcome to Sentientist Conversations.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
So as we've talked about before, this idea of sentientism is really a very simple pluralistic philosophy that suggests answers to the two most important philosophical questions. So one is, what's real? And sentientism suggests we should use a naturalistic approach that's based on evidence and reason. The second question is, what matters and where should we draw our moral circle? And there the clue is in the name, you know, all sentient beings warrant moral consideration. Why should we exclude any suffering? So the idea is, it's a very simple philosophical term. As you well know, it's been around since the 1970s, and in a way we're just trying to give it a modern recasting. But before we get into your perspective about what's real and what matters, for people who don't know your work, it would be great if you could just give us a quick introduction to your life and your focus.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I was a Dutch philosopher. I teach at Utrecht University. I'm specialized in environmental philosophy. I'm active as an applied philosopher, I would say. So I'm also an activist. I'm very much influenced and inspired by the philosophy of Peter Singer, who combines like doing philosophy is not only an academic matter, but also really changing the world accordingly. So I would say I have two main focuses in my thinking and action. One is epistemological, about the truth. So I'm an atheist, and also I'm criticizing religion. So I'm active in the atheist movement in the Netherlands, the free thinking and atheist movement. And the other aspect is ethical, I'm interested in helping to alleviate suffering in the world, wherever it is and wherever you can find it. In my work, I've devoted several attention to several topics. I've written about women in the world, women emancipation, feminism. About victims of religion or religious suppression, and especially, of course, non-human animals suffering from humans. And the last but not least is how we negatively affect future generations, both human and non-human, by how our contemporary system works.
Yeah,
that's basically what I do. I'm a writer, a lecturer, and I do a lot of public speaking and engagements.
That's great. Thank you very much. And to start with the first of those two deep questions that's the focus of your work, what's real? It would be interesting to wind the clock back and understand how your thinking about epistemology, the natural, the supernatural, has evolved even from, I guess, your childhood. Did you grow up in a religious household or a naturalistic environment?
I was raised in a middle-class liberal Catholic environment, I would say. So with liberal, I mean, they didn't bother me with it. I don't have any traumas from it. So there are not so much taboos, but I did go to church weekly till the age of 12 or so. I also went to Christian schools, but also very liberal. So I don't have any traumas from that. Then when I entered university and I studied philosophy, and I found out, okay, because I never believed anything of it. I just accepted it as some kind of stories. Yeah. Then I found out that I had a name, that I was an atheist. Like, okay, if I don't believe it, it's a label. So I found, and then I started to use.
And did you,
Do you think you did you never believe, even from as a young child, it was just those are stories and that's how you?
There's one thing. Well, it's an anecdote, but I remember I had a my boys' room was in the attic, and I remember that sometimes at night I would crawl under my blanket because I thought, what if Jesus would now knock on my window and say that you are the savior? And then I would go to the street and say, I'm the son of God. And I didn't feel like I didn't want to do that.
So you'd hide.
I'd hide. So that, but that's the most far that it ever got to me personally.
Yeah. So then you got to university and realized that there was a name for the absence of a belief in God.
Yes. Yeah. So then I came across the label atheist, and then immediately I started to label myself that, and I also started an interest in what's called philosophical atheism. And a little later, I thought, okay, but what am I? So atheist just means that you don't accept the arguments for the existence of any supernatural power, but it doesn't tell you what you are. So then I thought, okay, but I do have values, and but what are they, and how can they be labeled? And then I stumbled on this idea of humanism. And then I thought, okay, well, apparently I'm a humanist. So I started, like my whole life, my academic development is like searching labels and attaching certain labels to myself and getting rid of other labels. So I'm not a Catholic anymore, but so collecting myself, creating myself, that's also in itself a humanist ideal, of course. Constantly changing. So maybe I'm a different person in 10 years, probably.
But as you said, that's part of, you know, a humanist way of thinking is finding your own path, finding your own way, developing what is meaning to you. So
yeah, meaning, yeah, but with certain rules, and the rules are guided by reason. Eh? So it's not just going with the flow, but there has to be good arguments for you to attach or detach you from a certain label.
And my experience was quite similar in that I came from a middle-class Church of England, very anodyne, non-intrusive religion. And it still took me quite a few years to come to terms with leaving that religion, even though it was very gentle. But at the same time, I still felt the temptation of some other supernatural aspects as well. I just was always intrigued by the ideas of ESP and telekinesis and the paranormal. And, you know, were you ever tempted by sort of other aspects of the supernatural beyond deism and religion?
I've joined this skeptical movement pretty early, so I had an interest in that. I was a little bit intrigued by it, but to see how it was debunked. But I did have a serious interest in religions in general. I started Japanese language and culture, and I also have been in Japan. I lived there, so I had an interest in non-Western religions, especially Buddhism. And I also practiced Zen Buddhism, even for a very short period of time in a Zen monastery in Japan. But of course, this was not a belief in the transcendental, but trying to see if there was any wisdom, practical wisdom in those religions. Well, I also studied theoretically Hinduism. So I did my way of studying into those religions, and I found that basically, for me, there was not much to gain. Maybe a small tinge of meditation and the idea of ahimsa in Hinduism, which means non-violence. So there are some things that might also be useful for humanists, but it's less than I expected. So it was actually, so my road to humanism has been a long winding road via Japan and back again.
Yeah, fascinating. And it sounds like we have had a similar experience in that there's enormous value in many schools of religious thought. There's genuine compassion, there's introspection, there's understanding the nature of the universe and the world. But from my exploration, all of the positive aspects that you find in each religion predate those religions, and none of them require a belief in the supernatural. So
that's one. And the other thing is that they talk about compassion, but then you can go over a list of problematic things about compassion for infidels, apostates, women, whatever, you name it.
The compassion is often very, very conditional and very, very narrow. Any worldview that condemns billions of people to burn for eternity after death, I struggle to see the compassion in that.
Yeah, or whether or not you adhere to certain rules, and then you're punished for a very long time after death. I don't think that's very compassionate. So there's some misunderstanding that it sounds sometimes that like some religions are very humane and humanistic even, but well, I have serious criticism if that is also true in practice.
Yeah, I think, and there's a number of challenges with, I guess, supernatural bases for ethics, and that's one of them, that the compassion is conditional, or the moral circle is artificially drawn, or there's an in-group and an out-group, you know, and if you don't believe, you know, you deserve to be punished. Another one, which I think runs quite deep, is the challenge that as soon as you promote some concept as being more important than suffering and death of sentient beings, whether it's a god or a church or a priest, it's not just religious either. It could be, you know, the head of a one-party state or a national identity. As soon as something becomes more important than suffering and death, you tend to end up causing a lot of suffering and death. So I quite like, you know, the humanistic or the, as we'll come on to, the sentientist view, which puts the experiences of sentient beings as the central.
Yes, as you said, but it's especially also the individual suffering. So it's not, yeah. So sometimes in many political and religious systems, there's not so much value attached to individual suffering. So there's more value to the collective. And that's what I especially disliked also about my experience from Japan, that it's collectivism and not individualism. So that the individual might be crushed by the collective. Mm. And so that's what I dislike in all ideologies which are collective and not individualistic. And most religions, perhaps all, are collective. And a lot of political ideologies are collectivist. And humanism is one of the few, and with liberalism as well, which places a fundamental value on individuals. And of course, next question is, who are the individuals? But that's next step.
Yeah. And I guess that is the next step, because one of the reasons why I think many people are hesitant about moving away from the supernatural or a religious worldview is because they're scared that their morality will lose its foundation. So that without a perfect judge who can define what good and bad are, and even to, you know, punish us after death, that, you know, there is no foundation for morality. So some people will double down on a, you know, religious code of conduct because at least it feels objective to them, even if it's not well-founded. Others will go to the other extreme, which I also think is dangerous and insidious, which is a sort of complete relativism where they might say, well, you know, who are we to judge if a certain culture decides to cause catastrophic harm? That moral system is as good as any other. And I think both of those are fundamentally flawed. But you never really had a religious or a supernatural worldview. So how would you describe the basis of your ethics and what matters? And again, it'd be interesting to know how that's changed even since childhood. How did you decide what matters morally?
I'll start with a philosophical answer. I think that I am neither an objectivist, so I don't believe in objective values, yeah, nor am I a relativist. But I'm a universalist, so that means that I think there are universal values, but they're not somewhere written in the universe or by gods, but they are, well, created by humans, but still have universal value. Also, back into history, I mean, for example, I think it's possible to have a value judgment about slavery, that it is wrong, not only now, but also when the Romans had slaves. So it's wrong. And if you go to a different planet where they have slaves, it's still wrong.
Yes.
So it's wrong everywhere in the universe. But that's a universal statement. And the reason for that is, the argument is that it is from the point of view of the victim, it's wrong. The victim is someone who doesn't want that for him or herself to happen. So I would say that my philosophy is a victim philosophy. It's focused on victims. So I'm only focused in victims. So people often also challenge me, say, yeah, but religion has many positive things. Yeah, fine. I'm not interested in the positive. I'm only interested in the victims. Maybe a murderer has done many beautiful and good things. Yeah, that's fine. But you're still being judged for that one murder. So it's the victim that matters much more than all the other things. So that's why I focus on the victims, and you can make that universal by just putting yourself in the shoes of any victims, and that makes it universal, because no one but the same mind would be in the position of a slave anywhere in the world if he had the choice. So that's universal judgment. So that's what I what I think. And you ask me, how did I come here?
And also, has your judgment about what types of things or what types of beings can be a victim, has that changed over time? Did you start focused on humans and then broaden your moral circle? Or
exactly that. So indeed, when I entered university and I first started to read some of Peter Singer's works in applied ethics, then I was like shocked about, about non-human animals. And my partner and I, we decided to go vegetarian. And then took me a very long time to understand that the same arguments also hold then for vegan diet. So it's really, I feel a little bit ashamed to admit that even as a philosopher, it took me 2 decades to get from this point to the other point. So that's
me too.
Yeah, so it's.
But I'm not a philosopher, so yeah.
It's really an embarrassment, but that helped me to. Yeah, and since I really now try to see, are there any more blind spots? I mean, because that's the whole point. There are blind spots in our behavior and our thinking, which are very hard to, even if you cognitively understand them, to really feel them and to really also act upon them. So there's a lot of cognitive and behavior resistance to these blind spots. And I think that the role of philosophy or philosophers should help to find blind spots, to actively seek what are the blind spots in our society and to overcome these blind spots. But then I have to, I also read it's very shameful that not many philosophers are sentientist or vegan. Sometimes I like to, when I speak at philosophical conferences, it's a little bit not nice to say, but sometimes I say, well, probably I'm the only philosopher here because I'm a philosopher, therefore I'm vegan. Look, and Stijn Bruce is a philosopher and vegan, but most, maybe they are a little bit vegetarian, but
yeah,
not many vegan philosophers. I think that's a pretty a shame for what philosophy is as an intellectual endeavor. It's not just looking backward. It's really trying to look for blind spots. So it's not just knowing anything about Aristotle or Kant. But Kant says, dare to think. Well, dare to think means find your own moral blind spots. And also in myself, when I remember when I was, in my early 20s, I had this idea of vegans being these great crazy people, maybe left wing, I don't know. So some kind of, I come a little bit from, the posh circles, I would say. Yeah, so I really didn't connect with them.
Yeah, but then weirdos.
Yeah, weirdo. At a certain point, I was the weirdo. So they were right and I was wrong. So that is really, and now since that happened, I'm much more careful in to anything I do to see if I have to change my my set of labels. Yeah. So, but guided by reason, because it probably won't be that I will go back to being a carnist or anything, or being a believer, then my mental capacities are fading away. But,
but that's a trap that I think it's very easy for free thinkers and skeptics and people with a naturalistic worldview to fall into. And it's a trap for me as well, because my degree of confidence that using evidence and reason is the best way to understand reality almost approaches dogma, right? Because I struggle to understand what else there could be. But in a way, it's an anti-dogma, because by definition, I have to retain humility. I have to be open to new evidence. I have to listen. I have to engage with different ideas that I disagree with. But it's important to keep that humility, and not everybody with a naturalistic worldview does. And true with sentientism as well, right? We need to remain open.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said. So I have 2 circles in which I am engaged. One is my atheist and free thinkers friends, and the other one is my vegan friends. Mm. But most of my atheist friends, they are carnists. And many, not all, but many of my vegan friends, they are spiritual or religious, or there's no so much overlap. But I say to my atheist friends, from the point of view of victims, I'd rather have a religious vegan than an atheist mediator.
Yeah.
So they're really shocked by that. You know, from the point of view of victim, a religious belief doesn't necessarily have to be harmful. It can be, but doesn't necessarily have meat eating necessarily has victims. So,
and I think our compassion for people with a religious worldview means that we should respect the meaning they find in it and their right to believe whatever they like, but not to use that as a justification for harming victims. So I think I agree. Yeah. I mean, compassion, if you had to choose between the two, compassion is, you know,
so in neither of these two environments, they like me very much because they think I'm a dogmatic vegan or I'm a dogmatic atheist.
This is why it's great that you're helping us normalize the intersection of the Venn diagram. Because you're right. We are almost, you know, in popular cultural media, we are almost stereotypically the worst possible dinner guest because we're the assertive atheist and we're also, you know, fairly robust animal ethics and vegans, and we're doing both at once. But the interesting thing is, anecdotally, it does seem like there's a richer overlap than you might expect. So, you know, while there are many problems in the, you know, the vegan and the animal ethics environment that can be dogmatic or can follow supernatural or mystical paths that can take them into strange places, it does seem anecdotally that vegans are more likely to be naturalistic than they are than the general population. And it seems true of humanists and atheists as well, that although many of them resist the animal ethics argument very strongly, they're more likely to be vegan or vegetarian than the general population. I mean, and it's only anecdotal, and I'd love to see some more research on it. I was at a lecture given by another sentientist, Dr. Diana Fleischman, a couple of years ago by Humanists UK. So the audience, by definition, are pretty much humanists, and there were about 1,000 people in the audience.
Wow.
And I slightly cheekily asked a question of the audience instead of Diana and said, how many of you are ethical vegans or vegetarians? And approximately 40% put their hands up.
Wow, that's
wild. So I think there's a latent connection there. But you touched on, I think, a really important role of philosophy is pointing out those blind spots and those errors. And it can play that role. But it's deeply frustrating how slow that effect can be, given how trapped we are by social norms and, frankly, indoctrination from birth. And there seems to me a parallel both on the religious side of the story and the animal ethics and the moral circle side of the story, in that if you take a two-year-old child, they are like a miniature scientist in a way. They're using their senses, they're exploring, they're building a probabilistic understanding of the world. And then we, frankly, teach them fabrications and teach them that it's okay to believe without evidence. But the two-year-old would probably, I mean, I know some small children, you know, do pull the wings off flies, but most young children have a inbuilt compassion, not just to other humans, but they wouldn't really want to hurt a pig or a cow or a cat or a dog. They would normally feel some sort of sense of innate empathy. But again, we teach them from birth, parents, teachers, schools, society, that it's completely normal to have other sentient beings harmed and killed for your pleasure. It's difficult because on both these topics, it's very tempting to get arrogant and preachy and strident and righteous. But at the same time, it's so important to have compassion for the people that have been told these things since birth, right? It's completely understandable why they think that way. I do find an extra level of frustration when talking to people in the atheist and free thinking in the humanist movement, because on the one hand, they're very proud at the fact that they have turned away from a traditional way of thinking, turned away from a deep indoctrination. They've followed evidence and reason to get to a more compassionate outcome, and they're careful moral thinkers. Yet animal ethics remains like kryptonite to their minds. And, you know, even humanists whose thinking I deeply respect, and I have a page on sentientism.info of not quite sentientists who are, you know, really deep, powerful moral thinkers and public intellectuals, whose minds just seem to cease to function when you engage them on animal ethics, and they will say things like "but bacon" and expect you to take that as a serious moral argument. So I do find it, you know, I have unfairly high expectations of humanists when it comes to animal ethics, but there's these two dead weights of indoctrination that hang around most people's necks.
Well, I just agree with you, but because you would think that atheists and humanists, they use these arguments when they point to religious believers, you have been indoctrinated, so but it's hard to see that our carnistic upbringing is also sensitivizing, it's really a long-term effort to desensitize us, so as the people. And also, it's also like North Korean propaganda when we take them to children's farms. Like, this nothing has nothing to do with the real, real farming. Yeah. And keep the slaughterhouse away. And it's when you think about it, indeed, from that way, but it takes a while to get there. But you would expect critical thinkers to go there, but apparently it's hard. And indeed, that you say, yeah, that people should try to help to understand them, because we also had a long time getting there, how to do that. Yeah, but it might be hard. So how can we convince people? But it might be that sometimes the messengers might not be liked. So it can be that. Mm. So sometimes I accept that. So, okay, I don't have to be friends with everybody. I mean, I'm just here to make a point. And if they don't like me, well, I don't care. When I give lectures, well, they're also nice vegans, but, you know, I just make the point. So I'm not the nice, but they are nice vegans. Or they're nice atheists, but I'm not the one. So it's about which role to take. And I think I take the philosophical path, trying to give the best reasonable arguments for either of those standpoints, which might have a consequence that people don't like it or are shunned away. But it's also like pulling with a string, and you pull them and they don't get to your place, but they move a little bit, and it takes a while to, but if you start too shallow or not too friendly, they might not move at all. So,
yeah.
And also, it's an anecdote, but I gave once a lecture, and there was fierce opposition by a guy, and he really didn't like when they come up with all these questions after the lecture. Okay, and he was really excited and angry at me. Okay, but a few years later, he turned out to be the chairman of the Dutch Vegan Society.
Wow. So, you pulled on a thread there.
Yeah, so he started to begin with, you know, and he was really, it went to everything that was in his mind. So, but he was beginning to struggle, but his anger, he turned to me, you know, but I'm happy that it worked that way. And I don't mind that he was angry at me. So.
Yeah, yeah. And the anger shows at least an engagement in the topic. And yeah, I guess that's where.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's what we should also acknowledge, because if people just listen to you and clap and then go home and it didn't. Yeah. Stuck, but if they're really angry at you, then they have the problem in their head. So I mean, it's something that they have to struggle with.
And so one challenge to the sentientist worldview is that our moral circle's gone too wide, and we should focus back on humans as, you know, the only important beings morally. But there's another challenge which goes the other way and says sentientism isn't broad enough, and actually we need to grant intrinsic direct moral value to the biosphere, to the ecosphere, so biocentrism or ecocentrism or different forms of holism as well. Yeah. And you've written extensively on, you know, eco-humanism and environmental topics as well. What's your thought about whether we can go too far with our moral circle and the distinction between instrumental or intrinsic value for non-sentient beings? Yeah. You know, what can be a victim, and what's the limit of what can be a victim?
Yeah, so this is about axiology. So what has value? And indeed, there are moral circles where you can go. I don't believe in intrinsic value, because that's a very difficult notion about, and it seems to be like that there is some value ingrained in nature, and I don't believe there is value ingrained in nature. Okay, to make it more complicated, I feel a lot of sympathy to ecocentrism, which gives value and intrinsic value to ecosystems, so like the Amazon rainforest or the in the sea is some things. So the ecosystems, so that we should not destroy that. But then it's hard to give that a philosophical foundation. So I could say, as if it would have intrinsic value. And if I really have to give philosophical arguments, then I take one step back and I follow Peter Singer and says, well, you know, it has indirect value for sentient beings, because, and then it can be a lot of values. It can be, of course, direct, because we need it as for ecosystem services, but also recreational aesthetics, all kind of reasons.
Yeah.
So that's why I think that sentientism is the best way to go, because if you attach value to well, to all things that are alive, it's biosensors, but it makes it very complicated. And also, yeah, I think that the best argument, what has value in the universe, only is that things that can suffer and experience suffering or pleasure. And that's really goes back to the famous quote by Jeremy Bentham, can they suffer?
Yes.
And that's the only thing in the universe, and that sounds strange, which has direct value because that subjective feeling of something that matters. So that's really, that is the thing that has value for itself because it matters to itself. And a stone doesn't have that. But of course, there are degrees of sentientism, degrees of how beings can suffer and experience suffering. So that's, it is still skills. It's not a black and white thing. Yeah.
And I think I end up in a similar place in that I have common cause with most environmentalists and conservationists and have a deep appreciation for the importance of non-sentient environments for all the reasons you mentioned, aesthetic as well as ecosystem services and, you know, for our own survival. But I do think that that importance comes through their impact on the quality of sentient experiences rather than directly. So that, you know, if there's a mountain range on a distant planet that will never be experienced by anybody, you know, that only has any value at the point someone can observe it and see that it is beautiful. But if it's never observed and never experienced, it's morally completely irrelevant. At the same time, I'm not too concerned about people pushing their moral circle wider as long as they don't miss out any sentient beings. And I do find that deeply frustrating about many environmentalists and conservationists is that they've gone from a moral circle that includes humans. And because of that anthropocentric concern, we are worried about the environment because we need it to live. And then they jump to what could be quite a positive ecocentrism or a sort of holistic appreciation for Gaia as an organism or the planet as a whole, what, you know, however you like. But they seem to conveniently exclude from moral consideration all non-charismatic sentient wildlife and certainly all farmed animals and farmed fish. And it seems remarkably convenient to me that, you know, someone might say, well, I have a deep environmental concern. It's really just a reflection of what they want as a human, which is, you know, I want a nice environment that's pretty to look at, that will enable me to continue to survive. I want charismatic wildlife because I enjoy watching them.
Yeah.
So I want them to live, but I want to be able to eat bacon. So I want the farmed animals to die. And it's really just an anthropocentric concern
in disguise.
You know, in disguise. Yeah. So that's part of my concern about people jumping too quickly to ecocentrism or biocentrism is, okay, fine, if you want to do that, but don't forget the sentient beings that can actually suffer because a species, an ecosystem, a river, a rock, you know,
they don't
feel anything directly. They can't really be a victim.
Yeah, and I have had some debates, for example, with WWF, who exactly does that.
Yeah.
Not opposing to factory farming, not even, and in their own canteens, still serving animals. Yeah, well, just the same what you said, only about charismatic wildlife. So that's inconsistent. So that's also a basic point in philosophy, in some kind of philosophy that I think that for me, and also like Steinbrewer's example, is trying to be consistent in your whole, in everything. So in your worldview,
yeah,
consistent in your how you live and your activism. So that's also what I appreciate in Peter Singer's work, well, not, and in many others, but to be fully consistent and not, yeah, some other people, they including your worldview, that's what you say, that's the link with the naturalism and the sentientism.
Mm.
But many people, yeah, think that's difficult. Well, maybe it takes some years, but it's not. Maybe it's painful because you have to change your identity as you go along. Like, okay, if I take science seriously, I have to take out the idea that homeopathy works. I mean, that's just how it is. So yeah, you have to get rid of it then. But people seem not to care about consistency so much. And then we have to tell. But the thing is, if people say that, why should they care about consistency? Then the whole point is, why should I give a consistent answer to that then? Like, that's self-refuting. So it's, yeah.
And I love Stin's point is about arbitrariness and just rejecting arbitrariness. Yeah. Because as soon as a stance or a worldview or belief is arbitrary. You could literally make up anything, you know, and we could do it now. We can make up something completely laughable immediately, and it would have just as much basis. And I don't understand how that can be intellectually viable.
Indeed, not everyone. That's what I also think that intellectuals should do, to point out inconsistencies and arbitrariness of people's behavior and ideas. Well, I think in a way, as a liberal, it's fine what they have, but I still think as an intellectual, we should criticize all ideas for their consistency. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think the sentientism fits in with the project of the Enlightenment. I think for me, it's just one thing going on. They started out with a smaller moral circle, but of course they were already widening their moral circle to include people of all color and men and women. And now we are just writing it up. But I feel a direct line to the Enlightenment, people really trying to use reason to live a rational, consistent lives.
Yeah, I do as well. I think it's a straightforward extension of those same principles and taking them forward. And the only, I guess, the hesitation I have, and this is often used to challenge humanism and naturalism generally, is that people will say, well, you know, this is a modern Western creation. A few hundred years ago, risks being imposed universally on the rest of the world when there are different ways of being and different cultures and different ways of seeing. And I can appreciate that there's some caution around that because of the history of, you know, certainly powerful, rich nations imposing their views on others is horrific. The ideas we're talking about here weren't invented in the Enlightenment. They have really rich, deep roots that go back into Asian cultures, African cultures, European cultures, and arguably their rudiments are even pre-human. So if you think about, you know, non-human animals, in a way they take a naturalistic approach of using their senses to build knowledge that is represented in their minds about the world. And I'm not claiming they were writing encyclopedias or building websites, but they're, you know, the information, the modeling of the world and themselves was represented in their minds in a naturalistic way. And even the rudiments of morality, again, are deeply pre-human, and whether that's, you know, kin dynamics, pack dynamics, reciprocity, symbiosis. Again, you know, they're not writing philosophical treatises and saying, writing John Stuart Mill, but, you know, the rudiments of morality were developed because it's effective to collaborate and to propagate genes through certain ways. And, you know, that's the kit that humans started out with hundreds of thousands of years ago. And we've developed and refined it, sometimes made it better, sometimes made it worse. So while I do think it's a continuation from, you know, some aspects of that Enlightenment project, it doesn't need to be trapped by it. It doesn't need to be bound by it. And I'm also quite relaxed about a universalism, because if your universalism is about a totally open-minded commitment to understanding reality in an honest way, then that universalism, I don't see an issue with that. And if your universalism is about a broad compassion for every sentient being, that is a bulwark against oppression. You can't use that to oppress. It's a bulwark against oppression. And actually, a relativistic or a supernatural ethic is much more likely to cause oppression, because you exclude suffering from your moral circle. So I'm quite unashamed that sentientism, I think, as you've said, it's a universal approach.
Yes.
But it doesn't have to be oppressive. In fact, it's the opposite of oppression. Yes. It's a resistance to any oppression. It's a rejection of any oppression.
Yeah, people don't like to be reproached if they are themselves the oppressors. And then they will claim that you are a colonialist or anything. So, but yeah, that's just how the debate works. But indeed, I think it's, if you listen to the oppressor, you should always listen to the victim and never to the oppressor.
Yes.
And that's, for example, also in the political philosophy of multiculturalism, in which groups are given certain rights. Yeah, you know, it's, for me, that's fine as long as we keep a keen eye on the suffering of the victims, whoever they are, if it's gays or women or infidels or whatever. And the state should primarily protect the individuals as far as they can, including non-human animals as far as they can, and including the future generations, which are also harmed by, well, decisions we make or lack to make.
I think it's sometimes an honest mistake, and it's a well-meaning mistake, because a group of people will say that group is subject to oppression and people within that group are subject to oppression, so we need to respect them and be careful and not add to that oppression. But then that well-meaning approach can lead to ignoring the oppression of you know, minorities within those groups. And you've listed some of them there. So I think that's the check, is to always come back to that, you know, think about the individual oppressed being, you know, non-human, human, whatever their characteristics they are, take their perspective and resist however they're being oppressed, whoever's doing the oppression. And being oppressed yourself is no excuse for causing other forms of oppression on other victims.
Yes, I agree. And that's exactly why I think John Stuart Mill's philosophy with his book on liberty has like the basic rule of how to live together and what it means. So his basic rule is that, okay, let everyone do as they please as long as you do not harm others. And so anything goes as long as you don't harm others. And that's a very, very powerful rule. And many contemporary liberals and humanists, they have embraced this idea. And actually we live, sometimes I tell my students, you know, what is the book which has most influenced our society? And they point out to the Bible, and then it's that's nonsense. Look, it's On Liberty by John Stuart Mill. Yeah, you can make other arguments, but probably that's at least that we have a society in which you can be freer than ever on any place on the planet, except for some islands of liberal democracy. But so this is really exceptional. This is written and described in the book On Liberty, and no one, well, maybe they have heard of it, maybe, but haven't read it. So I think that's really something, yeah, we should change also into our self-perception and self-awareness. We keep referring to the importance of Christian Judaism. Mm. And I think that's, well, of course you can teach about that, fine, but then also include John Stuart Mill on liberty. It's so powerful and it has such an influence on that. John Stuart Mill was also, he was one of the first men in Parliament in the UK to vote for women's rights. So that's interesting because women weren't allowed. So he was in favor of emancipation movement, but still, of course, his theory was still about humans. I have developed two separate kind of theories. One is a humanist theory, eco-humanism, and the other one is green liberalism.
And
and
that's your new book.
Yeah. Mm. The difference between those two is between eco-humanism and green liberalism is that eco-humanism is a complete worldview or a Weltanschauung in German. So it is about atheism, secularism, humanism. So it is a whole consistent worldview. But green liberalism, on the other hand, is a much smaller political and moral philosophy. So perhaps you can even be religious or another worldview. So the packet is much smaller. So you have a much better possibility to find a broader audience. So that's why I have these two elements. Okay, I don't care. Not everyone has to be an eco-humanist. I mean, that's my fine. But you don't have. But green liberalism is different because that's about it rethinks the moral boundaries of our behavior, and it just the only thing what it shifts with Mill is to shift the moral boundaries from anthropocentrism to sentientism. That's all, and that includes then these two broad categories, so non-human animals or animals and future generations of humans, which, well, at the time of Mill were just not so much taken into consideration. And so there's two kinds of discrimination, actually, which I would like to overcome. One is speciesism, so that's a discrimination against non-human animals, and presentism, which is discrimination against future generation. So interesting, in our present day society, we are proud of, and I think that's good, that we are against racism and we are against sexism, and we try to also to move over ageism, all kind of forms of discrimination. And at the same time, we have two huge blind spots. Factory farming has been never been bigger than now. So our discrimination of speciesism. And again, I follow Peter Singer. That's just, no one wants to be a racist, but no one cares if they are speciesist. So it's like people saying, oh, I'm a racist, of course. Yeah, so I don't care. Like you can, maybe I understand what you're meaning, but I don't care. And that's actually what they now, what my very well-educated friends, they, even if they're liberals or humanists, if they're speciesist, they don't care. And even if you say, yeah, but you know, but it's really the same as being a racist. Yeah, they doesn't come through.
Do you think And this may be pushing things too far. Do you think substratism is another form of discrimination we may come to deal with? Can you imagine there might be a future artificial intelligence that could achieve sentience or...
Yeah, well, the
idea... I think that's a distraction.
I have a whole chapter about E.T. The E.T. is a fascinating movie. Really, yeah. Philosophical point of view, because there we see sentientism versus anthropocentrism. So you see the scientists who want to do research on E.T. to get him, and the boy automatically sees that as a sentient being, although it looks very different from us.
Yeah.
Boy has a more expanded moral worldview than the scientists. And then there's a fascinating other line in that movie. So I really, all sentientists should watch E.T. from this philosophical point. There, then the boy at high school, they do this biology class in cutting open live frogs to see their heartbeat.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
And then E.T. comes to the rescue. So it's like that boy also recognized, okay, but that's also, so he's the... That's like a moral awakening, but all the people the audiences are into tears for with feeling compassion for this weird creature which is non-human, well, but it's continued to within the carnistic paradigm. So it's like if you cry for E.T., you show you have compassion. Well, then don't eat meat. So that's the whole idea. So I think it's a it's fascinating to see how it works. But the answer is, of course, if anything has sentience, then it automatically falls in the moral circle. But you can also fall out of the moral circle in a way. So if you are a human being and you, well, for some medical condition, you lose sentience or diminishes, then it becomes, your moral status becomes much less. Of course, we have to keep into balance also the close family, of course, but then it's indirect value. Eh? So
The final section of the conversation, really, and you've already explored it to a degree, is what do you think the future might look like? So we're in this strange situation where you and I think that, you know, the naturalistic approach is somewhat obvious and incontrovertible, although we remain open-minded. We also think that using sentience as our guide for moral consideration is also pretty solid, but most people on the planet disagree with us. So most of the 8 billion people disagree with us on both or either. But if you can imagine a world where we have persuaded more people to take this sort of sentientist stance, an eco-humanist stance or a green liberty stance, what do you think that future could look like, and how long might it take to get there?
Well, in my more positive moments, use my default mode is cynicism, but in my more positive way, that moment, then I think when you look at the acceptance of homosexuality or LGBTQ, whatever the whole list, it went pretty fast. Because when you look back in history, in all cultures, and that's strange, there has been a rejection of homosexuals. Well, maybe some exception, but in general, there was a huge rejection of that.
And then you don't have to go back very far either. I mean, the conservatives of today are more liberal than the liberals of 50 years ago in many cases.
Yeah. So, but in history, so after the Second World War, from the 1960s with the sexual revolution, in a few decades, the acceptance went very, very fast, and also many Catholics, as you said, many conservatives, they even accepted. So that's the thing that there is. And then in 2001, the Netherlands was the first country to legalize a same-sex marriage. Belgium, second country in the world. So that is an example of a huge cultural change of paradigm. Of course, there's still some resistance here and there, but there has been a change in thinking that the majority of the people accepted in some way without any revolution, without any noticeable thing that happened. But so it might be that so there has been a change in paradigm. And some sociologists say, well, you only need about 5% of the people to make the thing go. So that make it optimistic, and that would also make it important. That's what I intellectual people speak out and try to make that happen. I mean, we can't know what happens in the future, but I mean, if John Stuart Mill wouldn't have acted for the cause of feminism, I mean, then we probably wouldn't have women's rights now. I mean, it's a whole project we have all have to work on, and it is possible that we can make that difference. And that's why I tell my vegan friends, like, if you just are a quiet vegan and no one notices, then you're not going to change the system. We have to change the system. And then I'm also a little bit of a utilitarian, and you can better be a meat eater and convince 10 other people to go vegan than being a vegan and convince no one else. So that's the weird thing about things. So I think it's important that, and that's why I also think why your network, the network of sentientism that we, and animal rights organization, the vegan organization that we, and the political organizations from the animal rights parties, that we try to make that world happening. We don't know what's coming, but if you don't do anything, we know for certain it's not going that way.
Yeah. Some people mistake compassion for weakness or appeasement, and they feel that if we have compassion for people we disagree with, that means we have to be polite and we have to hide our opinions. And I think it's the opposite. If we genuinely have compassion for victims, it may seem strange to say it, we need to engage with the people who are doing the oppressing with compassion as well. But we can do that in a very firm, direct and clear way. And both through the force of argument and, you know, philosophy, but also just from normalizing these ways of thinking. And that's why it's such a privilege to have you talking here today, because hopefully we're making another tiny little contribution to just making these ways of thinking seem a little bit more normal, so we can get towards that tipping point.
Yes, but indeed, what you say. So, but indeed, when you talk to oppressors, and indeed meat eaters, or most people are in that paradigm, people also they say to, well, but they might be offended or hurt, or that might. Yes, that's true. But offending or oppressors is not. Is indeed what you say is not what is the problem. We should look at it from the point of view of the victim. So that's why I don't mind when they are angry or offended or angry at me, because I have been also, I remember one time I was invited for a dinner in a, what is it called, where the cows are standing. So it was like an organic farm with cows. And they were eating those animals. But I did go there, and I, of course, I didn't eat them. And she said, you know, I am here because I give them a voice. So, and then they had to eat the meat. So, of course, wasn't very inconvenient dinner afterwards. But then I said, I am here not for you, but for them, to give them a voice. And because they can't directly speak, and I speak for them. And that's why also I feel I don't speak for myself. I don't speak for myself to become a nice person, but I have this ability, which has been also invested in me by society, that I can give a voice to the voiceless. And that's what I do. And that's why I think also I have a duty to do, even if it doesn't work. So even if I know it the project will fail, I still think that's why I every opportunity to give a public speech, I take, because I think it's important. It's not for me, it's for them.
Thank you. And while the human race can be a very frustrating species, we have a breathtaking capacity and capability to do good. And I think if you're right, if we can reach that sort of tipping point, I think we might surprise ourselves in a few decades, or hopefully not centuries.
Let's have an interview in 20 years and see and look back and that's also what the story I'd like to tell the audience is that when I imagine that I have grandchildren, it's on the point, and that my grandchild is sitting on my lap and ask me, granddad, is it really true that when you were young that they were eating animals? And that I would say, yes, it has been the case like that. And that they really can't believe that it was happening. It's just the same that now look back. Is it really true that we had a time that there was slavery, or that we had colonies and nobody thought about that? And I really hope that we can make that change in paradigm.
I think we will. And your contribution to it will be remembered. And I think hopefully your grandkids will thank you for it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much. And what are the best ways of people following your work and keeping up with what you're doing and making sure they get a copy of On Green Liberty?
Yeah, I'll send the link on it will be available soon on Amazon. I have two books in English. The other book is Philosophy for a Better World. It's also available on Amazon. Yeah, and but I do hope Green Liberty will get some attention. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it more thoroughly. I had a quick skim of the PDF you sent, but and we have plenty of Dutch followers and listeners as well. So I'm sure they'll be looking to your other writing too. So
thank you. Well, Jamie, you're wonderful. I'm a great admirer of the Sentientist platform. Great that you get all these people together. And well, thank you very much.
It's been great to talk to you. Thanks, Floris.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?